quality of life matters and there's a richness to a relationship, but I had to trust like that relationship enough to fully invest in it. Because when we were at a tough time, investing in the relationship and not getting the result I wanted, I had 10 times the emotion than investing in business and not getting the result I wanted.
Hey babes, it's Kayla Kraft with the Mommy Millionaire Podcast. I'm a mom of three littles, ER nurse turned self-made millionaire, and lifestyle entrepreneur. I am bringing you inspiring stories, business and mindset tips to help you be shameless in pursuing your ambitions. Welcome, Mommy Millionaires, to the show. Okay, Garrett. I'm so excited to have you.
It's good
so
to be
welcome.
Here.
Thank all right, you flew in all the way from Salt Lake City.
I did.
To do this show. So why are you so excited about wealth right now in 2019?
Well, I mean, right now we're entering probably one of the biggest times we're ever going to see with wealth transfer.
Oh.
Ever. Like, this is the longest period of time we've ever gotten without a recession in U.S. history. And during recessionary times, we can even go back to the Great Depression. A third of the people were like we saw on the pictures. It's like they're starving. They lost their homes and it was really sad. And a third of the people were actually maintaining, even though it was a struggle. But mm-hmm. a third of the people actually gained more wealth during the Great Depression. And this is according to Professor Gregory at the University of Washington. So what did those third of the people do?
Yes.
I really feel like I've uncovered that, dissected it. And it's a plan that isn't as complicated as most people think.
Okay. So you're going to teach us that today?
Sure.
And in the factory? Okay, why are you so obsessed with helping others create wealth now that you've done it for yourself? Were you obsessed with money as a child? Like, how did this happen?
Look, well, I came from like a coal mining town. And my I originally was born and lived in East Carbon, Utah, which is, I'll just give you a sense of East Carbon.
No idea, but yes, Utah.
So East Carbon was a town that I just went and filmed my origin story in. And when I ran into some old neighbors and they said, hey, when the peak of this town, there was 5,000 people and two cops. They're like, we're down to less than 1,000 people and five cops. Like, that's where dreams go to die. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's funny because when I showed up and I go in the grocery store, I got my film crew and driving a nice car, whatever. They just looked at us like we were aliens. Like, and then I just saw someone that I kind of recognized. I go, hey, my dad's Randy Gunderson. And then they were like, oh, what's up?
You're because Randy's boy.
I show up looking like Jesus or whatever, right? And they're like super confused about it. But when I think about like, there's so much confusion around money. And I look at the amount of pain that my family went through. My great-grandfather left San Giovanni, Italy, because he literally couldn't put food on the table. And mm-hmm. his wife got pregnant. He's like, how am I going to provide? So he doesn't speak English, gets over to New York. They change his last name because they can't understand him. I have the documents from Ellis Island from him. Then he gets on a train, gets to this small town where there were Greeks and Italians coal mining, and there's a mine disaster. So after the mine disaster, like there's no mines hiring, he has to become a goat herder. And it takes him 7 years to finally see his wife and daughter again. So he meets his daughter for the first time and she's almost 7 years old.
Wow. Right?
So he didn't have this knowledge. He didn't have this insight. What it did is it creates like a scarcity mindset within mm-hmm. a family that's like generational.
Yes.
Like they just believe you got to hold on to everything you have. Yep. You got to scrimp. You got to sacrifice. You got to budget. And it creates this reductionist thinking and no one shrinks their way to wealth. So when I saw my grandfather, who's my hero as a coal miner, but he had two side jobs. He played the accordion, very Italian of him, right? Mm-hmm. And he'd go play on the weekends and then he'd fix TVs. He's a TV repairman. And people would give him like tamales in addition to money and he'd get these community awards. And like he always invested in me before I ever had any sign. Like I was pooping in diapers at the time he invested in me, right? He had this irrational belief in me and unconditional love for me. So I just felt like, what can I do to make a huge impact? And when I won $5,000 being the Young Entrepreneur of the Year as a teenager, I thought that was a lot of money and I wanted to invest it to get out of this little town.
Yeah.
And that really got me on this fascination around money and how money works. And the more questions I asked, the more confusing it was. But as I started to see what was really going on, because at 19, 20, and 21, I spent more money on that than my college education, even though I got a degree. I spent somewhere every single month flying and interviewing people because when you're young, people will meet with you. You don't have to write them a check. They just want to pay it forward.
Yeah,
and I just knew
so
how
true.
To talk to successful people mm-hmm. because I learned that when I had my business competition, you know, with that first business I had. So, yeah.
Okay, so curiosity led you here.
Yep.
And you just...
I'm still infinitely curious too.
And I think a lot of people are not curious enough. They just accept the first answer that they get and, you know, give up on life, basically.
And better questions equal better answers.
Yes. How do you find out the good questions to ask?
So, I interview a lot of people. And by being mm-hmm. conversational, what I learned was the first question you ask isn't the question. It's if you really listen to someone's response and you're willing to ask the next question that peels back the layer.
Mm-hmm. The onion. Right? I always talk about that, you guys. It's the onion. It's peeling it back layer by layer.
Right. Yep. And like, I had a little red memo pad. Remember those little pads that you could flip over?
Yes.
That's what I had when I was 19 with questions. And I would go and I remember flying to New York for the first time and going and interviewing people. I had my, and they liked it because they're like, oh, look at this kid asking all these questions. Now, some people are annoyed by it, but I just found a way, you know, to get the meeting. So,
what was your mindset though? Because a lot of 19-year-olds, after they get their first no and somebody going, oh, this kid's annoying or whatever, they'd be like, oh, I just give up. So, how did you, you know, obviously you have that immigrant mindset, you have all these hardworking people around you, but most people would have given up. So, what are you thinking in your head to continue and persist?
All right. So, if we really want to get to the core of the matter here, this was the mindset. I'm 5 years old. I'm in kindergarten. I drink a chocolate milk. And then the teacher says, if you could turn that chocolate milk carton into a replica of your house, that's our art project. And I was like, I did my best work ever. Like at five, I my house was brown and white. The chocolate milk carton was brown and white. Cut the little windows, the door. And I couldn't wait to take it home and show my mom. And then the teacher said, you got to memorize your address. I'm going to put it up on the shelf. So everyone in the class has it up on the shelf. All the girls the next day had their addresses memorized. Every boy screwed off so that none of them got it back. But then the next day I was like, okay, I'm going to memorize my address, but it was cold. So I just went to the car early. And then it was the final day of the week. And it was only me and one other kid who's the class clown that didn't have their milk carton back. He got it right. Now the whole class is looking at me and I got my address wrong. And the teacher threw the milk carton away.
Wow.
So in that moment, I thought, I'm stupid. That's what I thought. And so it was my initial ambition to prove people I wasn't stupid. Yep. And I thought if I had enough money and enough information that I wouldn't be stupid anymore or wouldn't have to believe that I'm stupid. So that's what happened. I went out there to prove differently. And that's what motivated me early on. It's not the best motivation. It's just the start.
No, I think that you can use that type of pain to drive you. Right. And, you know, that's how exactly I was when I was a kid. I always had this need to prove myself because I thought people didn't believe in me because of little moments like that.
Right.
That add up in your mindset. Like, oh my gosh, I got to go bigger next time and get it right. So I love that because people listening in right now, everybody's experienced something like that, but most people feel buried from it instead of driven to go and ask the questions and push.
Right. Because there's, I am stupid, so I'm never going to do anything.
Right.
Or I'm stupid, so I'm going to prove that I'm not. You know, there's two different courses of action. And what was helpful is once I understood what happened, I actually literally sat on a couch like this, put a picture up of myself as a five-year-old. While I was talking to one of my friends. We talk every week and he goes, you need to talk to your five-year-old and tell him everything's going to be okay. Most uncomfortable thing ever, right?
That's literally the work I do. I tell everybody to do this work.
I'm literally talking to my five-year-old and he's like, do you think your five-year-old understands the words you're using right now? I'm like, damn it, no. But I'm like, you know, like I'm overcoming not being stupid. I'm feeling stupid in the moment. Mm-hmm. So I have the conversation. I break down crying. And I remember my wife woke up and walked out and she saw me bawling and she's like, what? Like she thought like something was seriously wrong but for me, it was just an emotional release. And then I realized anytime that I start to feel like I need to prove myself or I start to feel anxiety or angst, it's because I'm letting the five-year-old run my life.
Yes.
Versus the 41-year-old that's perfectly capable.
Yes.
Right?
Oh my gosh. You're the first guy I've had on my show that's talked about the inner child work. Because literally I was up late last night talking to a client because they're having a crisis or whatever. And we were talking inner child. We got to go back to 10-year-old little guy.
Once you know it, once you see it.
It changes everything.
And I could just see when someone's trying to do something, I'm like, ooh, child work. They haven't done any child work. And I think the whole game is how do we love ourselves?
Yes.
How do we just truly love and accept and embrace ourselves? And I love this John Lennon quote where he's talking about we have to love all of our glory and imperfections in order to be the artist that we were meant to be, in order to, you know, be able to express love. Because he's like, there's either love or fear. Mm-hmm. And if we succumb to the fear, you can't create. Mm-hmm. Right? So yeah, I just think that it's pretty here I am, the wealth guy, but talking about, you know, the start. That's really was the initial piece.
Now I'm obsessed with you. Huge fan. I was already a fan before. Now I'm like even more. Because this is the type of stuff that more men actually need to be doing. And I didn't know we were going to go here, but we're going here now. Because there are men that are listening in. Right. And there's a lot of wives listening in right now that need their spouses to do that type of work that you've done.
Right.
So what would you say to those like females listening in? How do they, you know, enroll their spouses in this type of work?
Look, my wife has been really phenomenal in this because I just think it's funny when we first got married because
And how long have you guys been married, really quick?
17 years. So 17 years that we've been married. I joke, 15 great years of my life. You know, years 7 to 9 wasn't our best years. Like, just kind of numbed out. Like, young kids, just a lot going on with my
business.
How old
were you when you guys got married?
I was 23 and she was 22.
Okay. I was 21 and he was 19 when we got married. So you're young.
Young pups, you know? But what's crazy is I remember going to visit her with one of my buddies over Christmas break, and she was working at Kmart, if anyone remembers Kmart. And I joked that I fell in love at a Kmart because we went, she had a stupid red vest on at Kmart, but I just remember driving down 3.5 hours after we met with her to go back to college, and I'm telling my buddy, I'm like, dude, I really care about her in a weird way. Like, it's really hard for me to admit these things. I was, like, younger at the time. And so much external validation and people telling me I was good looking or dating a bunch of different girls or whatever that was. And then all of a sudden that kind of happened. But here's the big thing is, like, she really worked with me on quality of life and putting our marriage at a top priority. Because when I started, think about it, I am stupid. I got to prove everything out. So my business was my priority. People are like, what's your hobby? I'm like, I have a business. They're like, you live in Utah. Do you ski? I'm like, business? Like, what do you mean ski? They're like, but what do you do for fun? I'm like,
yes.
Business. Like, how do you not understand that I have a business? Like, I was obsessed with just work, right? And she really chipped away at, like, first off, I was a miser early on, which is the opposite of how you get wealthy. I just
say that word. I've never heard that word.
A miser. So think about the Christmas Carol play, right?
Okay.
Ebenezer Scrooge is the ultimate miser.
Okay.
And if you left it intermission and didn't see the second half, then that's where a lot of people are stuck with their finances. They think if they just budget and they scrimp and they save and they delay and they defer and they work harder that it's going to work out. But hard work with the wrong philosophy still equals bankruptcy.
Absolutely.
And that's why year 7 through 9 was difficult in my marriage is because I wouldn't call it bankruptcy in my marriage, but it was like, my wife is like, would he put me before the business? Like, why is it that all the clients get all the attention and they're treated like whatever, but I'm not treated at that level? Mm-hmm. And to her credit, she confronted me about it, right? And that confrontation, I think for men, and I'll just speak for me personally, I feel like to get to the place of vulnerability and trust, to really invest all the way. Like, the first thing I recognize is, when people expect someone to love them more than they love themselves, that's arrogance.
Yes.
And that's why you feel a lot of arrogance from men. It's insecurity that comes across as arrogance. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of it is like validating through what they have or what they appear to have, the connections they have, the money they have, the physical manifestation.
And that's also what society shows you to do. I mean, a lot of
society tries to define success for us. Success is cover of a magazine. Success is a trophy or an award or recognition or amount of money in a bank account or the exit of a business. But the things that we really, like, if I remember writing down, what are my top 5 days in my life?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't when I hit New York Times or Inc. 500. It wasn't like a lot of the, you know, accolades that society would say.
Mm-hmm.
It was like the day that my wife and I were in Italy, in Venice, and two of our friends happened to show up and say, hey, we're in Italy. Are you guys in Italy? We're in Venice. And then there's 7 of us in a van, and we're convincing the woman to take us on this tour because we're only supposed to have 6 people going and drinking Prosecco, walking across this bridge with these amazing rivers beneath us, trying grappa and just like wanting to vomit because it's so hardcore, having amazing lunches, like laughing till our jaws hurt, going and having this amazing dinner at the best restaurant in Venice, and like, and then just like, you know, like being together. Like that was a day, and it had nothing to do with business. It had nothing to do with those. It was just an experience. And so my wife was at the forefront of saying quality of life matters and there's a richness to a relationship. But I had to trust like that relationship enough to fully invest in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we were at a tough time, investing in the relationship and not getting the result I wanted, I had 10 times the emotion than investing in business and not getting the result I wanted. Mm-hmm. It stung more.
So it's so much more personal.
Oh, it hurts. Yeah. It's more personal. Mm-hmm. But I've seen like when her and I weren't right, my business was crushing it. We were just, but I couldn't sleep well. I was had more like, I wasn't feeling all it these was like, loving thoughts all the time.
My, is my business doing well?
And that's the question. At what cost? That's a question everyone should be asking. At what cost is the game worth winning? And who defines success? Is it by default or is it because we recognize we're the author and that we're creating harmony, which means we're deliberately and intentionally creating our life?
Well, everybody listening in knows that they are the author of their life, but I think sometimes they have a hard time picking up the pen.
They think that circumstance is the author at times.
Yes.
Even if they don't say it consciously, they subconsciously believe that because of childhood issues, right? Like, look, when I was 3 years old, I got hit by a car. Right? Explains a lot right now. But I got hit by a car and my mom was walking with
me. I had nervous laughter.
So I'm with my mom on my Hot Wheels. She runs into her friend, Mary. They start talking. She lets the rope down. I try to cross the road. A car hits me. And my mom is pregnant with my sister at the time. My head gets cracked open. I'm bleeding. I'm crying so hard, I run to the lady that hit me thinking it's my mom. A cop sees it, takes us to the hospital, which is over 30-some miles away, but getting there fast. I remember sitting in my mom's lap in the front seat, crying. She's hysterical. And you know what I erroneously learned from that moment was, if I'm not perfect or I make mistakes, I hurt those I care about.
Wow.
And in learning that, what happened was I had this background stress every day. The first person was about my mom. Like, I never wanted to disappoint her or let her down. Then it was my wife, right? And so I always have this background stress where I want to control and fix and like think about it. Just love being fixed. Sometimes they want to be listened to, all this kind of stuff. But it's because of something happened when I was 3. Or we talked about the incident at 5. And so a lot of these things separate us from reality, from love, from acceptance, from creation, because fear starts to, you know, find its way in. And there's no greater destroyer of wealth than scarcity. Scarcity is born of fear, doubt, and worry. And worry doesn't lead to action. It leads to concern and stress. Mm-hmm. Like, when people are worried, they're not doing something about it. No. They're not sleeping.
No.
They're just thinking about stuff in their head.
They're living in a nightmare.
Right.
That's in reality. Yeah. And they can change that at any time. So you said your wife confronted you.
Yeah.
And so a lot of women, I think, and I give the same advice, like you have to actually tell him what you need and, you know, not be scared of the outcome, you know, even if he doesn't want to give you like this. So how did that look? Did it scare you? Like, what's going on in your mind?
All right. So where, where the confrontation happened was I had I have a good life of sharing all these like stories. So I had 2 business partners die in a plane crash.
Okay? Oh my gosh.
We owned a plane and they flew to do this event, and on the flight back they hit wind shears and the plane crashed. It was a private plane.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
What happened was, when that happened, I decided I'm gonna do whatever I can to keep all 3 of our offices going. We're not gonna get rid of a single employee. I'll be back on the radio. This was a Friday. I got back on Monday. I was like, I'll do whatever I can to hold this together and preserve their legacy, which sounds noble, but it's a stupid notion. Like, the only legacy I have to worry about preserving is my own. If you live your life for the sake of someone else, that's sacrifice. And sacrifice most of the time means giving up something greater for something lesser. Mm-hmm. That's how the world kind of uses it. So I kind of got stuck in sacrifice, sacrificing my health, sacrificing my life.
And kind of becoming a martyr.
Right. And that's it, like, you lose your power in that. So what happened was, for 4 months, I was getting up early in the morning before my wife and son were awake. I'm leaving. By the time I get home, my wife's awake, but my son's rarely awake because I'm trying to hold this all together with 42 employees. And the first day I was going to have off from June 9th, when it happened, was November 23rd, the day before Thanksgiving. Now, we're going to drive down to East Carbon, Utah, Price, Utah, East Carbon, Utah. Price is the big town of 12,000. So we're going to drive down there. And we have our best conversations driving through the mountains of Utah. Like, there's just something
about
that.
That's where me and my husband have really great conversations when we're in a car together.
Right, yeah. So we're just having a great conversation. And by the way, we have all the, like, appearances of wealth. We're driving a Bentley, which, by the way, I think is hilarious because when I get to my hometown, they just think it's a weird Chrysler 300 that there's something wrong with it, right? Like, they don't care. But so we're driving, and she's talking to me about being an extraordinary businessman or extraordinary radio show host or speaker. And then she looks back at my son and looks back at me, and she goes, but really just an ordinary husband and father.
Oh.
That's how she confronted me.
Wow. So it wasn't like, it was like in a nice way.
Yeah, but it was like,
but in a gut check way.
And this is what I would tell everyone is if you ever find yourself defensive in a conversation, it's because someone struck a nerve.
Mm-hmm.
We're not defensive if someone is saying something that's so not who we are. Like if I am convinced you're a Martian.
Yeah.
And I yelled at you.
Like, he'd be like, okay, this
whatever.
Guy's crazy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
What's happening?
But if somehow, you know, I said something that struck you like, whoa, wait, that.
Yeah.
You know, like if you get defensive, it's time to look at it.
Yeah, that's when you pull up the mirror and go, what's going on?
I didn't even get defensive because like I was exhausted at that time and I was just, you know, done. And when she said it, I just started to tear up. I do not like crying in front of her because it goes back to getting hit by a car. It shows a lack of perfection in my mind, right? She says it's cute, but I'm like, no, I'm the alpha, I'm the man. Like there's this whole kind of struggle with it. But she could tell if I'm emotional because the way I start breathing.
Yeah,
or how
she's
I clench
your wife.
My jaw. You know, like.
How old was your son at the time?
One.
So it was just in the, because he's 14 now.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just like in the perfect time before.
Yeah, like made a huge difference.
Oh my gosh.
Because I actually, 6 days later, I announced to all offices and all employees, I said, I won't be on email. I'm not going to be answering the phone. I'm taking a 30-day hiatus where I'm going to work from home. And I don't know what's going to happen, but you guys have been around. You know what to do. Figure it out. Stop relying on me. I'm not clear thinking as it is. And this is why. And they said, okay. And what I found was, this is when I wrote Killing Sacred Cows, because I had been spending, I only wrote 72 pages in 2 years on that book. And then when that happened, I'm playing with my son. I'm talking to my wife. I start working out again because I stopped doing that. So I'd gained 25 pounds basically during that time. No muscle in that gain. You know, just stress and emotion. Like I was actually getting ice cream every day all the way home and just nonsense. You know,
you're emotionally
just, like,
eating.
Oh my God, I just need to be.
The women listening in can,
I even bought
that.
Two sometimes because I was going to give my wife one and she never saw them.
That was bad. Okay, there's about the 25
pounds. But I mean, it was a lot of stress going on. So what happened is my son would go to bed and my wife would, and I had this new energy.
It's the play caused the creativity to come up.
The creativity came up. I call it the portal to genius.
Mm-hmm.
Two things happened. One, for the first time again, I believed I could have it all. I believed I couldn't have it all, that sacrifice was required.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I was like, wait, I could have it all. And so I started to create again, and I wrote it in 30 days. So I wrote it in 30 days, and then I even from that, so that was November, from December to April, I created a program, presented it to a group of entrepreneurs, and they said, how many years have you been working on this? Like 10? I'm like, no, I've been working on it for 4 months. Now, obviously, I had background information.
You had a lot of experience.
But
yeah.
The burst of creativity was phenomenal.
So what is the book Killing Sacred Cows about?
To me, it's permission to succeed because—
Why did you call it that?
So we were sitting down with my co-author. We had the stupidest title at the time. We knew it wasn't going to be the right title. And I go, you ready to kill some sacred cows? He's like, oh my God, that should be the title of our book. So I call this guy that taught me to meditate, very spiritual guy. I go, hey, I'm thinking about calling my book Killing Sacred Cows. He goes, well, it's really violent and in your face. I'm like, exactly. I need people to like listen to this. So sacred cows are unquestioned beliefs. So they get handed down from generations, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the elephant with the chain that eventually is so used to it, they put a string and never breaks a string. It's the people that cut the ends of the ham off because that's what their great grandmother did. It's because they had a different size oven. They don't know why they're doing it. It's just unquestioned beliefs that get handed down, and scarcity are those types of beliefs. So there's 9 chapters. And what happens is once you detect these kind of subtle lies, you know how to avoid them. Because subtle lies are like a feather to the face, not a brick to the head, right?
Give us an example.
So the biggest one is the finite pie. That's the biggest myth. Zero-sum game, win, lose, right? So that if one person has something that's less for another, that's the belief in scarcity. So abundance is really the way. It's human innovation. It's ingenuity. It's value creation. It's service. It's solving problems. And the more exchange that happens, there's more wealth.
Yes.
Like there's more wealth. It doesn't have to be more money because if I give you a dollar, it's not the end of the dollar. You get to take and use it again. So how many times does that circulate?
Mm-hmm.
Exchange creates wealth. And even the middle class today live better lives than the opulent of hundreds of years ago. I went to the Palace of Versailles once.
Okay.
Don't recommend doing that hungover, by the way. Oh my God. That was a terrible idea. But I remember like thinking King Louis XIV didn't have plumbing. had 1,000 servants, no plumbing. Mm-hmm. If he wanted food, there was only really what was available right there.
Yeah, he could postmates anything.
We're talking about months or years to travel. I can get anywhere in the world pretty much in 24 to 36 hours. Yep. And the few places that would take 36 hours are some remote places that I have to either get rent a private plane or drive in on some motorcycle or something. So it's like, I can get about anywhere. I've got plumbing, so my house smells really nice. You know, like it's just, we've just had an explosion of wealth now versus the past. And that's because of exchange, because we can learn from the past, because we can build upon what was already there. Mm-hmm. And because now with technology, we're exchanging at a faster rate.
Yes. That is so funny that you bring that up, because this morning I do these live coaching sessions like 3 times a week in my membership group. And we were talking about abundance and how if you would just pull yourself out and look at your life and the entire world, like from a bird's eye view, you would see that you're living in abundance right now. The fact that you're breathing, the fact that you have running water, like you said, like, and people are like, oh, like it's like a new thought. I'm like,
right.
Like, why don't we think about these things every single day and be grateful and then go about our work?
Yeah, and if you're in scarcity, I think the best thing to do is you have to do 101 things you're grateful for.
Yes. Like, every day.
It's easy. Like, if you're in scarcity, it's not easy. But today, mine was like, oh, man, I'm really grateful for my toes and toenails, and I could wiggle my toes, and for the arches of my feet. And I'm really glad that I have knees. I'm just like doing that. Then I'm like, ooh, but I love my truck. And then I'm back to like, you know, all this kind
the
of
material,
stuff.
The material,
yeah. Like, you know, and then I'm like, oh, just great that I could breathe. It's awesome to have, you know, that my I was cuddling with my youngest son last night, and he's a mini comedian. Like, I'm just going through it. It's like, and if you can, like, I've seen when my brainwaves are hooked up and focused on love, it's insane what happens to your brainwaves.
So what happens when you can stay in that state of gratitude and love?
Well, that's where abundance is born. And to me, I think love's the game. So I think that part of the human condition has become we're so good at pointing out flaws. Mm-hmm. We're like somehow we think imperfections are a problem, but I think imperfections are where we connect. And instead
Absolutely.
Of trying to
like,
hide them,
yes.
right? Instead of trying to like minimize them, like I do stand-up comedy. What makes comedy funny is imperfections. Like nobody's inspired by the perfect.
Right.
Right.
That's why I love social media, because I'm always talking about my flaws. Like last night I went on there and I was like, look, I forgot the kids' pumpkins at school and I have like this wet hair and people freaked out about it. Oh my gosh, I do the same thing. And it just gives people a chance to go, oh my gosh, she's so normal.
Right.
And like, it's all good. So I love that. Okay. So how, I mean, we have all this love. Okay. Yay. Kumbaya. Yeah. Now let's talk money.
Okay.
So there's a lot of network marketers listening in, a lot of coaches, a lot of people that are making $40,000 to $50,000 in cash a month coming in. All right. And I know from experience, my first 3 years, I made $1 million in commissions and I had nothing to show for it because I was not
You're
educated.
Good at making it, not good at keeping it.
Yes.
The demise of the entrepreneur.
So are a lot of people listening in right now. So let's talk about how do we make our money work for us?
Okay. So the simplest thing, but don't discount it, is to automatically save and deliberately invest. So we have to make a distinction. Savings and investing are two very different activities. And most people try to deploy their cash too fast. They try to invest too quickly. And ultimately, you've got to get 6 months set aside in just liquid savings. This is your peace of mind fund.
Yes.
Health challenges, family issues, cash flow crunches, changes in the economy, you've got staying power. So all you do is you pay yourself first, okay? So you go and set up a separate account. I call it a wealth capture account. It's a checking.
Ooh, I love the name of that, wealth capture. Yes.
Yeah, okay. I'm a naming fiend.
I can tell.
So thank you. So,
that's why you're not
so it's
there.
A checking, savings, or money market. Mm-hmm. You don't care about the return on the money, just the return of the money. And the reason you separate it is because there's something called Parkinson's Law, which was originally a study in time. So if you give an employee something to do by Friday at 5, when do most employees work on it?
Friday at 4 o'clock.
Exactly. That's a good employee instead of 5:15. But right, because it just kind of fills up with time and space. So they decided to take the study to money. And what happens is when people have an increase in income, their expenses rise to meet or exceed that increase.
Yes. I
There's a quote out there that says, you better start saving money before you make too much of it because it's impossible to save once you make a lot.
Mm.
Right? Because it's just
because you have the habits of.
Because a luxury once enjoyed becomes a necessity.
Yes. Yes. I believe that.
Okay. So yeah, just a quick story on that. And then I'll get. So like I'm flying to go work on my keynote. I've got this director and my chief of staff books my hotel last minute. And once I got there, I just emailed my director and her. And I was like, And I signed it. Prima Donna Gunderson was the, but I was like, I can't do it. I can't stay here. There's got to be a better place. I won't sleep. This is gross. God. I just can smell. It's like, I just don't feel good.
I literally just did that like 2 months ago. Yep.
And so I'm like, I don't care if they refund us. I just have to go to a different place. Spot.
Yeah.
Now, when I grew up, that's what I would have thought a hotel was. Like, I didn't know any different, right? But I know different.
You'd have been like, oh my gosh, this is I wasn't the most asking beautiful
for,
place.
I wasn't asking for a boutique hotel. I wasn't asking for 5-star. I was just asking for something that didn't have, you know, anyway. So, so you pay yourself first. You set up the separate account because you don't want your funds commingled. If money sits stagnant in a personal account or a business account,
you think you can
businesses have insatiable appetites. And the personal side is like part of the reason why when income goes up, expenses can rise to meet or exceed is because entrepreneurs spend optimism. If you make $1 million now, you know you're going to make $1 million
make
more in the future.
Next year.
Exactly. So there's that. So you separate it and you take the money off the top. Now, my recommendation is 18% of personal income, not business revenue off the top. I'll tell you how to get there. You don't have to budget to do it. 18% because, well, I don't know if we have time to go into all that, but there's a reason. It used to be 10%, but now we have inflation. Now we have major debt with the government, so taxes could go up.
Mm-hmm.
And the last 3% of the 18% is actually a living wealthy account. So you set up one more account. The living wealthy account says, if you're taking care of yourself, take care of yourself. Go ahead and go spend it on whatever's guilt-free. You know, don't worry about it. If you want to upgrade and do lay-down seats, if you like clothes, if you like nicer wine, like whatever it is that you might consider a guilty pleasure, you just go and you go, hey, I've got 15% going to my future. I'm going to take 3% to just blow on whatever I want as long as it's not going to have a negative consequence.
Okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So to get to that, then we're going to look at four I's. The first I is the IRS. People are way overspending on their taxes. They're tipping the government unnecessarily and have a framework to save them on that. The second I is interest. Interest, there's a process called cash flow optimization. We look to reallocate inefficient resources like low interest rate savings accounts or CDs or underperforming investments and pay off higher interest rate loans because that's a guaranteed return. Renegotiate. All loans are negotiable. If you haven't renegotiated your interest rates in the last 2 years, you're probably paying more than you need to. The third R is to refinance, right? Or restructure. So let's say you have a paid off car, but you have a 10% interest rate on a credit card. Refinance the car, pay off the credit card. Now you're going to get a 2.9% rate of
That's so smart.
Of loan. And a car loan helps your credit score. A credit card hurts your credit score.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot to it, but I'm just giving you the basics. The third I is investments.
Okay.
Make sure you find out where there's hidden fees. Unperforming fees, you know, underperforming fees, like you're paying something, but you're not getting anything for it, or protecting your downside. So if you are invested, you know that when the market corrects, which it's going to, you don't have to participate in that downside. And the fourth I on this would be insurance. There's a lot of duplicate coverages or improper structure. So I call this being more efficient. We look at the four I's, find that money, and that's what funds your wealth capture account. And tax is a huge one, because if you've overpaid, you can go back 3 years. Like, for example, right now, what we're doing right now, I can save you tax. Okay? This is super simple.
Chase, listen up.
So, you're filming in your home.
Yes.
We can use something called the Augusta Rule, where what would it cost to Airbnb a similar quality home? You can charge that to your business. Your business gets to write it off for today's filming, but you don't have to claim it as personal income for 14 days a year. It's called the Augusta Rule. So, you know, let's say it's $3,000, let's say. That's $3,000 tax deductible. So you're just essentially putting, you know, in California, that's like $1,500 in your pocket.
Oh my gosh. I'm excited about this.
So
I like money.
That's just like, there's so much on the tax side.
Yeah.
So much. Okay. So now the third thing is you've got to create economic independence. That's where you have enough recurring revenue to cover your basic expenses. That happens in one of two ways. One, assets that kick off cash flow. Two is businesses that kick off residual or cash flow. When that can cover your basic lifestyle expenses, that means every active dollar you earn is not encumbered by taking care of your lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So where everybody else is trying to save 10% of their money and earn 10% on it, you can save 100% of it to grow your assets, invest back into your business. So the way to get economically independent is, so plug the leaks. The second thing is to what I would call engineer wealth. Find out what your monthly amount that you have to pay and expenses are, and then reverse engineer and say, what's my plan to get there? Is it paying off loans and it lowers the bar? Is it investing in something that creates cash flow? Then the third one is to accelerate investment income. Anyone with investments, make sure they're cash flowing rather than accumulating. And then the fourth thing is to scale business revenue. Almost every financial book you buy and read won't talk about the advantages of a business because they're trying to get to your money to manage it. And if you're investing that in your business, they can't get to that money. Mm-hmm. So invest in the things in your business because you can have 20% or 50% growth in a business in a year. It's going to be hard to get that in a stock market. Like Apple's not going to double in size next year.
Yeah.
Right? And then the fifth one is to make it count, which is relaxation, rejuvenation, recreation. You're your greatest asset, not a stock, bond, or piece of real estate. So you invest back into yourself. So those are the five levers that create economic independence. So you focus on economic independence and cash flow. But you begin with paying yourself first, plugging all the leaks, and then you're going to, you know, essentially, I'll say it this way. You're going to do everything you can to make as much money as possible. Do everything you can to keep much as possible without budgeting.
What?
And then grow your money after that.
What do you say to people right now that are, I just had this question this morning,
yeah,
that are in debt, mm-hmm, okay, maybe about $50,000 in debt. They think that's like the end of the freaking world. Mm-hmm. And right now, all they can do is focus on the fact that they're in debt.
Okay, so if they have a retirement plan, borrow from the retirement plan and pay the debt off. It's done today.
So you do you believe that everybody should have retirement plans?
I don't believe in retirement plans.
Neither do I. What about life insurance?
It depends on the type of life insurance and how it's being utilized. Like I use something called the Rockefeller method, where okay, I first discovered it because GE was doing this back in the 1950s. They wanted to recruit really good talent, so they would give them a pension. But in order to pay for the pension, they'd buy life insurance on the person. They'd use the cash to supplement the pension, but when the person died, the money came back into the company tax-free. So there are ways to do that in an individual basis. Like my kids have life insurance on them because I'm going to invest in them, not in the stocks in the future, to help them figure out their skill sets, whatever they're going to do. And then they, if they have a mishap or the economy doesn't cooperate, the life insurance will replenish the trust because I finance everything. We don't use banks. So we're going to finance whatever for the kids. We'll capture the interest at a lower interest rate than they pay a bank. So I'm getting into the rabbit hole here a little bit, but so
it's expanding people's minds. So it's good.
But retirement plans, my problem with them is they're typically government sponsored and the government's $23 trillion in debt. So I don't trust them as a partner.
Right.
It doesn't focus on cash flow now, has people abdicate and shirk responsibility because they just hand their money over and they hope it's going to work out. Well, there's a bunch of fees. It has a neglect cash flow.
Yeah, they feel like they take advantage of people that are, you know, not educated.
My belief is retire in business, not from business. Build your business to a place where it's a choice whether you have to be there every day, not a requirement. And that's what real retirement is.
Okay, if you were to start from ground zero right now, okay, knowing all that you know now and you're like, but you have zero cash, mm-hmm, what would you do?
Well, zero cash, then that doesn't matter because I'm really resourceful. It's not about how many resources you have. It's this equation that I run my life by.
This is so good, you guys. Like, listen up.
It's called the value equation. And financial capital is the least significant piece of it. It's the byproduct. So the value equation says it's your mental capital, ideas, knowledge, wisdom, tools, strategies, insights, multiplied by your relationship capital, subscribers, clients, friends, family, mentors, network. Yes. Right? It's your mental capital times your relationship capital that determines your financial capital. And business is merely a bridge between your mental and relationship capital. So if you have high leverage with that bridge where you can reach a lot of people as an influencer, mm-hmm, as a thought leader, then you're going to have more opportunity for financial capital than if you're just trading time for money. So all I would do is I go, what mental capital do I have? I still know everything that you mentioned, right?
Yes.
What relationship capital I have? I already have all these people that I know. But what I would do is the same thing I did with killing sacred cows. It didn't require money to hit New York Times because all I did was pre-sell 22,000 books before I ever had it finished.
Wow.
I just went and said, okay, if you want to buy the book now, I'm going to give you this, this, and this today.
Give them a bunch of bonuses.
Nobody else is going to get it. It's for you guys right now today, but then you'll get the book when it comes out. So I pre-sold 22,000 copies. So it didn't take money to make money. It took resourcefulness. It mm-hmm. took the value equation, leveraging mental yes. and relationship capital.
Oh my gosh, so freaking good. I love that equation. And I think a lot of people listening, I talk about resourcefulness all the time. Mm-hmm. You got to get gritty. There's always a way to get what you want. And I think a lot of people have a hard time seeing the open door that's right in front of them to get them to where they want to go. So what is the mindset shift that they can do right now to start being resourceful?
To be resourceful? Like I think what would be helpful is if they just made a list of what their mental capital is, like what do they know mm-hmm. that's unique? And we discount that sometimes. We mm-hmm. think other people know it. Mm-hmm. We think other people know it. Like, and then write down your top relationships and then specifically and strategically have meetings with those top relationships, whether it's every other week, whether it's in person, whether it's over the phone, because those are the people that are going to be your biggest cheerleaders. They're going to be willing to collaborate, promote. And so if you'll simply do those things, you've already figured out how to be more resourceful, but you've got to do anything today. You got to start with scheduling it now. You've got to do something immediately. Like, and these are my mantras.
Stop thinking about
done is better than perfect yes. and progress over perfection.
Oh my gosh. Because, I say that all the time.
You know, like progress over perfection. I think too many people are perfectionists because they're worried that someone's going to judge them. And guess mm-hmm. what? They are, but they're going to come from scarcity. So their judgment doesn't matter. I've just recently launched this YouTube channel and I've actually been responding to any negative comments. Some people are like, don't respond. But I'm snarky and have a little of the comedian background the to me yeah. too. But what I found is 90% back down when I respond.
Oh, yeah.
I just, you know, like, they're oh, and of course you're going to sell your internet. Books. I'm yeah. like, would you rather me not write the books? And I'm like, what's your problem with someone selling a book? Do you not, are you against reading? Like, yeah. I just, and then they're like they have no argument to it or they're like, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think that people on the internet will just say whatever because they have nobody.
There's no accountability. Keeping them,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The only ones I don't respond to is if I don't know what the hell they're talking about. I just go, I don't even know what to say to that.
Yeah.
Or if they're just like shamelessly plugging their something, then I don't respond. But other than that, I respond to everything right now. Just well, while I'm like waiting for something.
I hope that that empowers the people listening in right now because if they get a negative comment, they immediately take it personally. And
it's not personal.
It isn't. It's all hurt people.
Yeah.
And yeah. right. Yep. So it's like, it's take it back to them. If you want to take the time to make a comment, we'll ask them a question back.
Well, like, this is how I think of it. When I wrote Killing Sacred Cows, the first version of it before it got published, it was a self-published book. And my wife was in a reading group. And that reading group, she was 8 months pregnant. So she didn't go to the one where they read my book. And then one of her friends called her and said, dude, they hated Garrett's book. They were like so negative about it. And she called me and she was pregnant. So she was crying when she called me because I was in Chicago. And I was like,
she's taking it personal for you. Yeah.
I was like, is everything okay? And then I remembered I had this shirt that said billionaire with fuzzy letters on it. And her mom threw it away because I loved it at her house. And she was crying about that. So I'm like, okay, hopefully this is no big deal. But then when she goes, they hated your book. I can't believe it. I go, oh my God, if they would have liked it, I would have had to go back to the drawing board. They're the biggest bunch of socialist complaining bees that I've ever been around. I can't stand that you're even part of the group in the first place. So, like, good. Like, if everybody agreed with what I said, why did I write it?
Right.
Like, I've got to have some degree of challenge, you know. Yeah, the New York Post, when they reviewed it, they said, if everybody did what Gunderson said, then no one would ever take out the trash. I'm like, right, we got robots that are going to be doing that anyway. So who cares? Or kids. So like, you know, I don't care about their negativity because it's all about their experience, not about mine.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So
I did care at one time. Not going to lie.
Okay.
My first negative Amazon review pissed me off. Now I don't even care. I had someone threaten me with an email with a 1-star Amazon review. And my response was like, what would I ever do? Like, who cares? Like, I'm like, go ahead, give it a negative review.
You
doesn't
know what?
Matter.
I feel like I, after 9 years in business now, the only thing that bothered me was when people attack like me as a wife, because they'll say things like on my podcast review, oh my gosh, I saw this on social media and blah, blah, blah. And now I just always take it back. Like, nobody knows like really what's going on like behind closed doors. And I just have to go, am I okay with how I show up as X, Y, and Z and then move forward?
Totally.
You know? So, I mean, if it does bug you, it's take it and look in the mirror and just say, why? Yeah. Okay, maybe I do need to be a better wife or a better friend or whatever it is, better author.
I had someone say, I prefer Dave Ramsey's videos. I'm like, then go watch Dave's videos.
If you like Dave, you're not going to like you.
It's good.
Right?
Go watch him.
Yeah.
It's fine. Like,
you're not going to be everybody's favorite flavor.
He's good.
Yeah.
At what he does. He's really good at what he does. It's different than what I do. It's cool.
What is the most shameless thing you've done to build your business? That's the tagline of Mommy Millionaires. Be shameless in pursuing your ambitions.
I remember speaking at this event like a decade ago. And like it was the ultimate pitch fest. Every speaker got up and pitched. Every single one.
Mommy Millionaire Live is not like that.
There was not a single, and there was this one guy, I won't even name his name, but like he literally did a hypnotist show.
I think I've had it on my show.
And then sold it, and then sold from that. And it was just so, I was like, why am I here? And it was because I was at a cash crunch at the time. I would have never said yes to it. To my justification or defense, because I still wouldn't do it again. I remember walking up and I'm like, hey, you want me to sell? I'm like, I'm not going to sell. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give this form out to everybody. And I'm just going to tell them, look, you're all in different situations. I have no idea. So just cross out the number. Just put whatever number down that you want and I'll give you the whole thing. I don't care if it's a dollar because you're dead broke right now. You just have to have some skin in the game. And everyone, like, I got hugs. People were crying. Like, I felt better, but I still felt like I was associated. And, you know, we have a firm that we both have in common that we've hired. And like, I always feel for them when they call me like, hey, so-and-so wants to have you on the show. I'm like, no, don't like them. I'm like, fine. It's not that I don't like them as a person. I just don't like the message.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not in the message of like, hustle, just work your life away. Like, it's just not my thing.
Right.
I'm starting to like realize I'm willing to interview them. I don't know if I'm willing to be interviewed. I'm like trying to figure out the way to kind of like leverage that properly, where I could still be true to who I am, but still reach more people. Mm-hmm. And so I've opened up to that a little bit more and just trying to figure it out.
Well, so I like what you did, how you just, that's totally like you, I mean, did that help you grow your business though? Like, I'm sure you got a ton of people.
We got 117 people that have in forms.
Yeah.
I mean, I even just feel like this video I just posted on YouTube with me and Kiyosaki, I don't love the, I don't operate
we'll
the
link
same
up
way
that,
he does.
We'll link up that video, you guys.
Like, he gets so many comments, you know, because he really wanted me to badmouth a couple people and I wasn't really comfortable with that. And I'm a huge admirer of Rich Dad Poor Dad. I think it's a phenomenal book. But that interview was interesting because it was an hour and a half and I only posted two shorter videos from it because I felt like every time I was really teaching, he stopped me to tell me to dumb it down.
Because he wants it to be more entertaining instead of educational?
What he's been masterful and I could learn from him is he's like a great storyteller.
Yeah.
And he's great at like keeping it
You're
overly
good at
simple.
Telling stories too, though.
I just feel like it was too simplistic. And I don't agree, leverage debt to get rich. Like, not everybody should go leverage debt. They should leverage mental and relationship capital. And if it's the right mental capital, borrowing might make sense. But for the majority of the population, don't borrow because they'll borrow
to
consume.
Get this right.
And they haven't even got their taxes handled right. They haven't even plugged the leaks. They haven't even set up wealth. It's like, that's a good step for someone in the right situation. And Kiyosaki understands real estate. It's part of his investor DNA. Risk isn't in the investment, it's in the investor. And if someone just goes out and goes, I'm going to go do that. Well, if it's your first real estate deal, you don't know what you're doing. You can get your butt kicked going and getting a loan and end up with negative cash flow eventually. So there's a lot to the story, but he's brilliant with the sound bites.
Okay, so last question. Let's say everybody has their personal finances in order. They have 6 months in savings, all that kind of stuff you say, which I love.
Yep.
They have $100,000 extra to invest right now. Where should they invest it?
So if they're asking me where they should invest it, they're not ready to invest. Because some people are really good with real estate. Other people suck. Very few people are good at the stock market. Most people suck at the stock market. Some people are good with tax liens. Some are too bored. They don't even know what that is. Like for me, I invest in intellectual property. I invest in my three companies, Wealth Labs, Wealth Factory, and Ripwater. And I don't invest in real estate because real estate doesn't fascinate me. I'm not passionate about it. I'm not unique at it. I might be able to get by, but it would be drudgery for me to go and create books, to go and create content. I consider myself as douchey as it is an artist, right? And that's the art that I want to create. And I want to have an amazing aesthetic to it, which finance hasn't done a great job at that. I want to bring entertainment and comedy to that. That engages me and it allows me to invest in myself and then express that. And so I have intellectual property that I license to people. I have intellectual property that creates recurring revenue for me and created economic independence. And I believe in focus, not diversification. Diversification for too many people is diversification. It takes good money from them and their business and puts it into things they don't know or understand and puts them at unnecessary levels of risk.
Whoa, so. That is good. Okay, I love it. So this year, what are you investing in for yourself?
So I just did a 6-figure contract to build my keynote to be a one-man show, to be like Broadway level. So I have a director, I have a comedic writer that's working with me on it as well, and we have a screenwriter. So that's something that I'm investing in heavily. Last year, I bought a lodge, kind of like a cabin, but nicer than a regular cabin.
Yeah.
That's not really an investment in like cash flow, but I built a podcast studio in it. So we put a killer podcast studio and we create this killer experience that people can have if they come out to the lodge and be part of the podcast. So that was an investment. I'm investing in...
What's your podcast going to be called? Because by the time this airs, it'll be... Okay, it'll be called Wealth Labs. Okay.
So
we'll link it up for you guys. Yeah,
so we got that. I mean, I'm investing in my Win Then Play book. So Win Then Play is my book that I want to be a 20-year, you know, New York Times bestseller, like be part of the common conversation and shift people's mindset away from playing not to lose, where they're holding on to the past, playing to win, where they're just hustling and working hard in an entrepreneurial treadmill, never enjoying life along the way, to how they set up a journey that's worth being on, they create a game worth winning,
yes,
they make sure the juice is worth the squeeze. And to me, that's the most transformational work I've done.
All right. When can we expect that book?
We'll be pre-selling it in 2020 because I've already done the audiobook. I've already created these four written materials around it that'll be exclusive for that. And then I'm writing the playbook right now, the top 10 ways to win then play. So that'll be pre-sold in 2020. I think the book might get delayed all the way to 2021. I don't want to release it during the election. It's just too much noise during that time. And I want to launch it right at the right time.
But I'll pre-sell
for a year.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay. So we'll link up where they can pre-sell or where they can pre-order it or whatever. Oh my gosh. Well, this has been so much fun.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. We got to talk about all the things.
I haven't let you rest your voice because I talk so much.
I was very appreciative of them. Like, water, more water. Thank you so much for coming and being on the show. Seriously.
Thanks for having me.
If you guys loved this episode, I want you to take a screenshot of the podcast and tag both me and Garrett on Instagram. Maybe we'll repost you. And let us know what you loved about this show. That's what fills our cup up and continues us on our work. So thank you guys for listening in.
Thank you for listening to the Mommy Millionaire Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to mommymillionaire.co. Make sure to follow Mommy Millionaire on Spotify and subscribe on iTunes. And it would mean the world to me if you left a 5-star review of the show. And as always, ladies, go out there and get what you want.